This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network in World Affairs, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dr. Margot Tudor, a host on the channel World Affairs. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Christine Schroebel-Patel about her new book, Marketing Global Justice, The Political Economy of International Criminal Law, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. Christine is a reader in law at the University of Warwick. Christine, welcome to the interview.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for taking the time today. And I was wondering if we could begin the interview by you just giving us a bit of a better idea about your background, telling us a bit more about yourself, where you grew up and how you became to be an academic.
Yeah, great. So I grew up both in the UK and in Germany, but I had my main legal training in Germany, where I did an undergraduate degree at the University of Heidelberg, where law is really taught in a very formalist way. It really is stripping out any of the politics, the philosophy, the history of law. It's very much looking at the present and understanding recent legislation and what the courts are doing and so on. And I suppose there was always a little bit of a dissatisfaction about just seeing law as this apolitical, formalist body. And so when I came to the UK to do my master's, a whole different part of thinking in legal terms was opened up for me, which I found much more engaging and inspiring and really allowed me to think more broadly. So I did my PhD then at King's College London, and really in a critical legal tradition. And after that, I went to the Netherlands. During my PhD, actually, I spent some months in the Netherlands at the International Criminal Court, which is relevant to the book and why I eventually wrote the book. But at the time, I was researching on global constitutionalism, and I wasn't really that interested yet in international criminal law. And I came back to the UK, where I took up my first permanent lectureship at the University of Liverpool, which was really fantastic because it gave me the opportunity not only to be in a fantastic city with lots of political struggle as well and interesting history, but also a department that really allowed me to pursue my teaching and research interests. And now I'm at the University of Warwick, which is known as a university, or certainly many departments are known for being open to thinking about contemporary struggle and radical politics. So it suits me really well to be at Warwick.
Fantastic. That's so fantastic to hear. Warwick is such a brilliant university. So I'm not surprised that you've settled in really well there. And so I just wanted to kind of bring back, you were just talking about thinking about global constitutionalism. And so obviously this book is your second monograph after this first monograph on global constitutionalism in international legal perspective. And so I kind of wanted to ask you, how did you have that shift? How did that tricky second album come about with this book? And how did marketing global justice become the book it is today?
Yeah, I think so. When I was researching on global constitutionalism, I was thinking about the universalizing of very particular values, political and legal, and how they had traveled from this Western Enlightenment tradition to the rest of the world. And one of the aspects that became really important to me when I was thinking about global constitutionalism was hegemony. And hegemony understood in a Gramscian sense of how concepts can be imported or exported rather to other parts of the world, in particular from the global north to the global south. And when I then went to do an internship at the International Criminal Court, where I was much more interested actually in treaty making, I was sort of interested in public international law rather than international criminal law. So I was interested in how the International Criminal Court interacted with other international organizations, how those treaties and agreements worked. And I realized that there were many parallels with between the project of international criminal law and the project of global constitutionalism, that universalizing of particular values and how those have traveled from one part of the world to the other part of the world. That's sort of really what connected my project. I have to admit that I started my internship in 2007 at the International Criminal Court really thinking that this might be a different institution. I had bought into the idea of the International Criminal Court being a counter-hegemonic institution in some way. I'd read the Rome Statute beforehand. I looked at the website. I thought that this institution, also because of its positioning in a subtle way, but in a significant way against the US as well at that time, I thought that that really made a difference. And then when I was at the International Criminal Court and got an insight into the working of it, I became extremely disillusioned and came back from The Hague thinking, at some point, I really need to write about this and work through this disillusionment in a productive way. So I think there was a lot of emotion being overlaid onto this experience in The Hague that I wanted to work through and understand in a more structural sense.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of the themes then really do take forward from that first book into this book, because definitely. And when I was reading Marketing Global Justice, I was really fascinated about how you use this concept of marketing to think about power and to use that idea of political economy to kind of access some of those more high level ideas of hegemony and high politics is really, really fascinating. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you, in your book, specifically define marketing, because that's kind of an interesting aspect at the beginning of your book, and how that relates specifically with the global justice sector. I mean, specifically with the ICC, as you've said. I really enjoyed your section on legalized morality. So it'd be great to hear more about that.
So I think that marketing in itself, saying that marketing plays a role in international criminal law, is probably not surprising to anyone, because the terminologies of marketing are part of international criminal law. People talk about stakeholders and they talk about persuasion and they talk about communication a lot. But what I found was missing in that analysis were is the material aspect of that, right? So it's often used in a discursive way. So to talk about the logos of international criminal law is often then it stays on that sort of superficial level of thinking about image and image making and communication. When I started researching on marketing, I realized that actually there is a much more profound aspect here to be worked through. And that particularly focuses on the distributive aspects of marketing. Marketing is not only about communication, it's also about how resources are distributed and then also potentially not redistributed. And so the question of persuasion through marketing that I really highlight at the beginning of the book, and the question of distraction and attraction to certain issues that happen through marketing can be seen in what I call the global justice sector, in that certain aspects are spotlighted, but they're not just spotlighted discursively, they're spotlighted in terms of resources. The aspects that are really highlighted in terms of anti-impunity, that is then where all of the global justice resources have gone, at the expense of a much broader, much more radical understanding of global justice.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. And so thinking about the section that kind of flows on from that, the thinking about those material aspects, I was really fascinated in drawing attention to the 1990s. You know, there's this particular moment for marketing and having that neoliberal moment almost in the 1990s at this simultaneous moment for international criminal law. Obviously, when we think about the Rome Statute, when we think about the ICTR, the ICTY, all of those different movements all happening in the 1990s, it's really this transformative moment. And so I was wondering if you could just kind of take us through what drew you to that decade as really kind of the opening of your book, and how indeed those kind of industries were brought into this profitable relationship with one another at this particular moment.
Looking at histories of international criminal law through the 1990s is not the usual way to start talking about the history of anti-impunity. A lot of recent studies have focused on that period of imperialism in the 19th century and go back further to the 16th century and all those periods in between. Or they start after the Second World War in 1945. And looking at the 1990s as a much more recent history, then connects all of those different periods, but really focuses on what was specific about that time of tribunalization and institutionalization of the idea of anti-impunity. So the rhetorical connection between the 1990s and 1945 is really key to how I understand that history of international criminal law, because, of course, histories of international criminal law that start up with 1945, they talk about the overcoming of the dealing with the crimes committed during the Holocaust through the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals. And then they sort of tend to say that there was then a period in which not much happened. And then the New World Order started, this new universal idea of internationalism began in the 1990s. And that's when all these all the resources could be put in, finally be put into the tribunals. But again, thinking about it materially, I was interested in how was it that these concepts of anti-impunity suddenly specifically in the 1990s took on so much purchase, and why was it that those who had been advocating for a permanent international criminal court and had been advocating for tribunals and had been advocating for the idea of anti-impunity. Why was it that specifically at that time it grew, it exploded as an industry? And this is where I see an important connection with branding and the corporations moving to ideas of transcending the product. And certainly a big influence for me was reading Naomi Klein's No Logo, in which she looks at how corporations in the 1990s moved from thinking about products and to thinking about ideas, right? So going from the concrete thing which is being produced through labor to then moving to the abstract notion of the brand. And I saw lots of not only parallels, but I saw a dialectic there, that corporations were speaking about values. And today we can see that in this sort of corporatized idea of activism in particular. And that also international organizations themselves were learning from branding strategies, seeking this idea of going for the big the big ideas, rather than feeling obligation to show how this was really being implemented. And this is something that I saw very concretely at the International Criminal Court, where very few cases were being heard and very few cases are still being heard. And at the same time, this rhetoric of global justice is so central to its working and also its attraction of resources. So the 1990s, I think, is fascinating as a decade, post-Cold War period, in which markets were opening to the East and also more to the global South. These corporations were really centering on that idea of competition and were institutionalizing that. International organizations themselves were stabilizing that process, right? So we're not talking only about the International Criminal Court, we're talking about the WTO and international economic law. We're talking about the international financial institutions and a global system in which the market becomes dominant, supported through states, supported through international law.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was what was so powerful about that first chapter. I think definitely it was such an important decade for bringing together those ideas that perhaps before then had existed in cooperation to various extents, but really this moment. And I love your use of Naomi Klein. I think that book is really brought into the center of how we think about branding. And I suppose that kind of brings me on to my next question about the political economy of visibility and value, because of course that's a really important facet of how you think about what the market value of global justice, how those sectors work together in alignment together. And I think it also provides a lot of lessons for scholars of humanitarianism when thinking about how that visibility and value are kind of negotiated. And I was wondering if you could just expand on for our listeners on the idea of political economy of global justice and what is seen as global justice, quote unquote, what that visibility or invisibility means to you.
So I work through the question of visibility through the analytic of spectacle in the book, very much influenced by the work of Guy Debord, where visibility, and I connect that to the contemporary idea of the attention economy. So where visibility, again, is about attracting resources particular people become commodified for this attention economy. Now, I work through that in particular by thinking about the distributive effects of stereotyping. And a very central aspect of the book is to think about how victims of global injustice are being exploited. Now, that's probably quite a provocative thing to say, simply like that, victims of injustice are being exploited. So I work through it quite forensically in the book to show what I mean. When in the global north, humanitarianism is invoked and the images of victims are used, this is often for the a donor community that is in the global north that is considered to be this seeing and knowing and giving community. And then a distinction is created between those in the global south who are the receiving or on the receiving side, who are those who are seen rather than those who are seeing. So the really foregrounding of images of victims and the stereotyping of images of victims is really central to this attention economy. And now in the book, I explain that there is a certain racialized and feminized and infantilized image of victimhood, which is produced and reproduced in the global justice sector in order to attract resources, because this is the most familiar and the most comfortable image of victimhood for this global north donor community.
Yeah, and I think especially when we think about the commodification of that particular type of victimhood, it's really, really powerful. And obviously, you then go in to talk a little bit about the Kony 2012 campaign, which obviously is a key example of how celebrity of global justice and perhaps the celebrity of particular forms of victimhood, or how we imagine victimhood in the global north, really frames the approaches of the global justice system to global responses, and how marketing really is integral to that process. And so I suppose when we're thinking about the Kony 2012 campaign, what drew your attention to that as another important moment in your argument, and why it went so viral, I suppose, in 2012, which is kind of 12 years since the Rome Statute has been, or 13 years since the Rome Statute has been around, and what did this specifically mean for that sector at that point?
Yeah, Kony 2012 was absolutely key for the global justice sector, for identifying what the global justice sector was about, and also for the International Criminal Court at that time. So the International Criminal Court had issued an arrest warrant against Joseph Kony, who was by the International Criminal Court portrayed as central in the crimes being committed in Uganda at that time. And since the International Criminal Court doesn't have its own police force, and there's no international army that can act on these arrest warrants, the International Criminal Court is very reliant on the communication of the arrest warrant and someone taking that on, and someone saying, well, okay, we'll arrest Kony, but we'll not only arrest him in the country where he is, but we will then also send him to The Hague to stand trial there. So Kony 2012 came at a great point in time for the ICC, because that communication then really meant that it went global. The idea of the International Criminal Court as this central institution for catching the worst criminals that are out there was really put together in this 30-minute video that then went viral. Now, what was so fascinating about the whole Kony 2012 campaign by the NGO Invisible Children, and, you know, the prosecutor of the ICC has a cameo in the video and so on. So it's very much tied together with the whole idea of the ICC. But what was so central about Kony 2012 was this idea of let's make Kony famous. Mm. And now I think at that time that was, and now also that's normalized in order to attract attention to an issue that is connected to the idea of being famous, of celebrity, right? So George Clooney says in this part in the Kony 2012 video says, you know, Kony 2012, he should be on the cover of Time magazine like I have been. And there's this cult of celebrity which is applied to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and atrocities. And that sort of glamorizing of global injustice is something that actually I think is normalized in our society of celebrity humanitarianism, but is something that I think we should be very uncomfortable about. Because then certain issues, again, are spotlighted, but they're not spotlighted because those who have been affected are bringing this forward through political struggle, or because there is some kind of political process in which certain aspects are being spotlighted, but rather it is an NGO that is using marketing techniques, that is using other celebrities in order to work with that idea of celebrity. And again, what's really interesting about Kony 2012 is that it was mostly an online campaign, which means that it went viral through people clicking on it, sharing it, voicing their how much they care about this issue. But at the same time, it just didn't really translate to a political activism on the streets where those in the affected areas felt that this was their issue, or those even those who had shared the video multiple times then really translated that into protest or other forms of political activism. It was really this viral perspective only on happening through social media, really. And what struck me about that is that not only sort of the clicktivism that you might talk about, but also how activism is turned into a commodity, and how it's essentially consumers who then, you know, through supporting the Kony 2012 campaign or supporting Invisible Children, they get then a bracelet, they get a poster, and so on. This is this consumerist idea of global justice and how to fight global injustice. So Kony 2012 is absolutely central to thinking about marketing and marketing global justice.
It sounds like it's part of such a longer trajectory of kind of celebrity humanitarianism, from kind of even abolitionist movements about boycotting sugar that had been picked on plantations, and then you kind of bringing through those lineations to kind of Band-Aid, and then it's almost like an explosion of all of those ideas brought together with technology at a particular moment, and you've got the facilitation of the ICC and how it's framing itself at that particular moment. And I suppose a follow-up question to that is how Kony 2012 has affected future marketing campaigns. You know, has it completely transformed how people at home, in donors in the Global North, conceive of their own relationship now with global justice? Is it far more kind of a process where they can do it from their couch, or that kind of couchtivism, and has it benefited donor recipient relationships, or do you think it has really kind of re-entrenched those hegemonic relationships that you were discussing at the beginning?
So the backlash against Kony 2012 and against Invisible Children was almost immediate. And just as much as the campaign was in the foreground, so was then the critique of Invisible Children itself. And the marketing literature is actually very, very mixed on this backlash. So on the one hand, it shows that questions of humanitarianism can go viral, just like, you know, some kind of singer says something and that can go viral, right? So this idea of humanitarianism going viral, that is obviously something that the marketing literature is very interested in. But at the same time, this backlash is also very much at the forefront and thinking about how NGOs could go viral but then do better than Invisible Children. And this backlash was something that I bring out in the book and is a theme towards the end of the book that becomes quite prominent, where I highlight that backlash is often understood in market terms. So the backlash against Invisible Children was a lot about, well, how much of the money is really going to those affected communities? How much is going back into the organization itself? So how much is staying in the Global North? I think those are all valid questions, right? And the backlash also was about, well, you know, this white dude who speaks through his son, his young son, right? So the communication through the son in order to break down something that is incredibly complex and simplifying it for a broad audience and so on. So that backlash, I think, is important, but I felt like it doesn't get to the aspects that are key here, which is, again, the commodification of the children that have been affected in those communities, of the victims. It's the, again, the making visible of certain things while invisibilizing other aspects or sanitizing other aspects, because a very important part of the Kony 2012 campaign was the lobbying of the Obama administration for military intervention in Uganda. And in fact, that was successful, right? So this is celebrated in the video. What I found was missing in that backlash against Kony 2012 from many quarters, from the marketing perspective, from the NGOs, and from the more critical literature, were bringing out really these issues of the structural inequality, which is so much part of the humanitarianism at display there. And that's why in the book I make a distinction then between backlash, which is grounded in ideas of the market making humanitarianism more efficient, for example, and contrasted with resistance, which is historically informed and in that context of Uganda takes into account the colonial histories, takes into account the exploitation of resources at that time, aspects again that are often hidden are the important resource implications. And I try to connect those and I try to bring those into the Kony 2012 story in order to show what has been invisibilized through not only the campaign itself, but also through the backlash against it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Kony also fits into that very comfortable image that you were discussing earlier of who a war criminal or someone who the ICC should be prosecuting looks like or acts like in a particular way. So it fits a lot of the categories that that would have enabled that marketing to continue that extractive process. And so I think with the next chapter, when you start discussing a little bit more that neoliberalism aspect and focusing a little bit more on the court itself, I imagine for some of our listeners, it might be slightly difficult to imagine how the ICC can perform as a neoliberal agent or have that kind of neoliberal market influence kind of shifting and shaping the court from its very beginning. And I suppose it would be great for you to just kind of discuss that, but also building on exactly what you were just talking about, how it's almost rebranded during moments of resistance as well, and pushed back against any criticism through those market ideals and methods of acting. That would be great. Thank you.
So on neoliberalism and the ICC, I really build on, or the International Criminal Justice Project more generally, I really build on work done by Kamari Clark and Tor Creever and Ritchie Baz, who have shown that the focus on anti-impunity is at the expense of thinking structurally about justice. And I do that in the chapter on the International Criminal Court through expanding that work and thinking about the interactions there between other institutions and the International Criminal Court. Essentially, the question that I'm interested in there is, how is intervention on behalf of the International Criminal Justice Project creating markets? How is capital accumulated through the International Criminal Court's intervention? What markets is it enabling, and what is the justification for those markets. So very much, again, thinking about the question of distraction. Marketing has a key role to play there in distracting from the markets that are being made safe for investment through the involvement of the of international organizations. And here I think, yes, thinking about markets being made safe for investment is probably a question that would not usually be one looked at in international criminal law, that which is so focused on individuals. It's so focused on identifying who are the perpetrators, the technicalities of the criminal law as well. Was there mens rea? Were there accomplices? Right? How do you attribute responsibility and so on? So all of those questions of criminal law mean that the question of the market and how capitalism works and how capitalism is connected to the concept of crime, that those are tend to be hidden, and that's where my focus is on the chapter on the ICC. And one of the aspects that I focused on in that chapter is the withdrawal, in effect, it was only one state that eventually withdrew, but the withdrawal announcements I was much more interested in, of South Africa, Burundi, and Gambia. And I interpret that as three states saying they no longer want to do the labor for the International Criminal Court. They had signed up to a counter-hegemonic institution that would take colonialism and contemporary forms of colonialism seriously. And what did they find? They found that the International Criminal Court was only focusing on African states, only focusing on African perpetrators, and was not the counter-hegemonic institution that they had thought it would be. And so they say, we're laying down our tools. We're going on strike. We no longer want to be part of this institution if it is exploiting us for the benefit of those who are already in power, right? If it's sustaining those hegemonic structures that have these legacies from colonialism and so on.
It's so fascinating because those withdrawal announcements were so interesting in the sense of the backlash from the global north, or particularly kind of in a British media audience, was, well, they're withdrawing from justice, like the concept of justice they are now resisting to, whilst also at the same time the conversation about British and US crimes in Afghanistan was being pushed off the table. And it was almost like the most explicit demonstration of double standards within this particular sector that I've ever seen. It was such an interesting chapter, thinking about how those market tools and those ways of resisting particular forms of, accountability, or also just thinking about hegemony through market values, is something that I don't know if any other scholars are thinking about for international criminal law. So yeah, definitely super fascinating. And I suppose bringing it back to the idea of marketing, on your next chapter, thinking about how branding is absolutely crucial. And we've discussed a little bit about Naomi Klein's No Logo. And I know I have a lot of colleagues that work on the UNHCR and US AIDS branding, making sure that their uniforms, their trucks, their food sacks are always visible in all their campaign marketing. And so I just wondered how branding has kind of played a role in shaping not only the public conceptions of global justice, but also its geography. So thinking about branding as a geographic tool as well, I suppose we've mentioned The Hague before, but also thinking about other sites of justice as well. So how the particular tribunalization, I suppose, as you've discussed, is particularly attached to ideas of geography and sites of justice.
Yeah, so Within the global justice sector, I was interested in the book in the different actors and NGOs, as we've discussed with CONI 2012 and their campaigns. They're sort of an obvious choice in terms of who is competing in that global justice sector. A perhaps less obvious choice is to think about it, as you say, geographically. What states, what cities are competing in that global justice sector? In other words, what places are using global justice as a means of capital accumulation? And again, having lived in The Hague, looking at The Hague was an obvious choice because it has a city brand of a city of international peace and justice. And I knew about this city brand because when you live in the Hague, you are aware of it. But I was fascinated to see just, again, it goes to that point of branding is not just about the rhetoric and the communication. There's a whole industry there. There have been books written about the branding of The Hague, and it's also considered as a example of very successful city branding. Because The Hague has not only attracted resources, it's attracted international organizations. It is the place of international justice, which means that it has not only the professionals that have moved to The Hague, it's got the institutions, it's got the whole industry around it. It's got the restaurants, it's got the facilities staff, it's got the cleaning staff, it's got the housing and so on. It's a city that has thrived in terms of capital accumulation through highlighting its work on international justice. And living in The Hague, that often feels quite bizarre because you find yourself at receptions, certainly pre-COVID, many receptions with those advocates of international justice who speak about the importance of The Hague, the importance of this location for other parts of the world. And you sort of look around and think, well, I don't really see any representatives here of that other part of the world. There's a real sort of celebration of this idea of international justice. And the image attached to it. The city branding of the Hague as a successful city brand of attracting resources on the basis of global justice, I found very interesting. And then in the chapter, I look at South Africa, and I look at Cambodia as other examples of place branding. So there's city branding, and then there's regional branding, and then there's state branding, nation state branding. And nation state branding, again, is a big industry. There are people who have made their careers through this, most of them, interestingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, based in London. That's where the nation branding offices sit. And this is about thinking about the commodification of the state, right? Thinking about what messages can be simplified about a whole nation state and its people in order to attract tourism, in order to attract trade, and in order to attract investment. South Africa, I found, was very interesting because we spoke about the withdrawal from the International Criminal Court. And at that time, there was a big discussion in South Africa about what that means, right? Different NGOs also within South Africa expressed their horror, really, at the state doing this, but also the business community. because the business community said if we withdraw from the International Criminal Court, then we are harming our brand of stability and of internationalism and of global justice, right? So South Africa, of course, has a important history of transitional justice, of moving from an apartheid state to a democratic state, with all the problems that come with it. And I talk a little bit about that again in that transition, the prioritizing of neoliberalism there. So the business community being concerned about South Africa withdrawing from the International Criminal Court was something that really fascinated me. And that disjuncture there also between city brands, regional brands, and nation state brands, and the population, because there is an expectation that the population will live according to this brand. And that means that certain aspects which are considered as marketable are foregrounded, and certain parts of history that are seen as not marketable, they're completely placed in the background. So if you look at the nation branding of if you look at the city branding of The Hague, for example, you won't find anything about Dutch colonialism, because it's not particularly marketable when you're putting yourself forward as the center of international justice. And the same applies in South Africa, where certain aspects are highlighted and then others through no political process, right? These are marketing executives that are making those decisions. What do we highlight about this state and its people? And how do we expect then state officials, how do we expect the population, the people, to act in accordance with that brand? And what might that do that could be damaging for the brand? Yeah, and the third example then in the book is of Cambodia, where international justice has played a role through the extraordinary chambers, the ECCC, the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia. And here I saw some different dynamics taking place, in which there was not so much a state branding infrastructure, but rather there was a disjuncture between the elites who could focus on the use of branding global justice, and then those who have been marginalized in society, they're the ones who often focus on the dark sides of global injustice, trying to so again it shows a neoliberal a mindset and trying to get some value out of dark episodes of its history. And I say dark here because the term that is used for this is dark tourism. I'm going to see skulls, I'm going to see the killing fields, specifically in Cambodia. And this different use then of branding a place in terms of whether it's aligned with its branding of global justice. And here we can think of also, you know, apart from South Africa and its move and its transition, we can think of Germany, for example, as a good example of a state that that focuses its state branding on global justice. And then Cambodia, where it's much more fractured, and you actually need to look at the societal class differences in order to understand who has the privilege of using global justice as a means of capital accumulation, and who the rich pickings, if you will, of the global justice sector, and who is left with having to market the global injustice. Those are sort of the local, you know, the locals who want to also gain a benefit from tourists who might come and view the skulls in Cambodia. And so who is also using global justice as a form of capital accumulation, but is having to adapt that to a form of dark tourism and global injustice.
Yeah, I think that last point is especially important, just thinking about how profit is drawn and attracted to these particular spaces, and it's almost seen as a benefit of the global justice sector in the sense of, oh, well, you've given these people a career, the tourist industry is now doing so much better, whereas actually then that bigger structural extractive process is, like you say, diminished or sidelined or made invisible. And so I suppose with all that in mind, that kind of terrifying structural context in mind, your last chapter kind of draws us back out again to think about challenging this. Like, how can we actually think about reforming, or is there space for revolution within this global justice sector and the relationships built within that? And I was just wondering if you could kind of bring us into a more positive state of what you've thought of as a potential way to challenge these extractive relationships.
Yes, I'm often accused by my students of being really cynical. And so this chapter is in a way for them, because the critique of these structures, it doesn't end with the critique. And I think that's important for me. So that final chapter in Marketing Global Justice is about the idea of what I call occupying global justice. Saying that it's important to retain something about the idea of global justice, so not to dismiss it and say all of global justice is terrible, but to say that important movements in history have attached their struggles to this idea of global justice. So how can we think about an anti-marketized global justice? Now, I don't lay out in that chapter sort of a route, if you will, for anti-marketized global justice, but I do set out some ideas of what I think could be important in thinking about how to marginalize the market values that have been so central and the competition that has been so central in the global justice sector, and how to bring forward the social values that have historically been important, not least in the global justice movement, which was an anti-capitalist movement at the time of the setting up of the WTO, and with the Battle of Seattle and so on, was an incredibly important voice for thinking critically, going to the streets, protesting, thinking critically about the distributive and lack of redistributive policies of the international order. So in the chapter, I highlight these four tactics: unplugged global justice, despectacularized global justice, unmasked global justice, and resistance global justice. And all of them have limitations, and they also contradict in some aspects. So it's really saying that these tactics can be employed as a way of occupying the global justice at different times and by different people or groups involved in struggle. I'll just go through them very briefly in turn. Unplugged global justice is this idea that shut down the overly marketized aspect of global justice. You can refuse to share images of infantilized and racialized and feminized victims. It is possible to stop that circulation. Despectacularized global justice is about thinking. It's related. It's thinking much more about the contextual. It's thinking about the slow and the quiet, really highlighting that spectacle is about the attention economy. So if we move away from the attention economy, how can we think about structural harm in a considered fashion? And then unmasked global justice is almost in contrast to despectacularized global justice, because unmasked global justice uses satire, and it can use spectacle, but for an anti-marketized idea of global justice. So to highlight the stereotypes, sometimes you need to point to them, and you need to point to them and point out sometimes how ridiculous they can be, right? I sometimes, when I teach international criminal law, I show my students clips of, say, David Crane at the special court for Sierra Leone giving his opening statement. And they laugh. The students laugh because it's so crass. It's so over the top. And sometimes you have to be able to. There's a privilege. And I think that's really important to emphasize. There's a privilege in laughing, and there's a privilege in satire. But sometimes it is important, and I think that it can also be done in a delicate fashion. And then there's resistance global justice, which is about really foregrounding and anti-imperialism, foregrounding agency, thinking about movements in the past, groups in the past, say the Black Panthers have gone out there and used their power acknowledge the power that they have and used it for political struggle. Again, that is really in contrast or in contradiction with despectacularized and unplugged global justice in a way. But so I think it is important to say that these different tactics can be used at different times. But overall, the idea is that all four of these tactics turn to the idea of anti-imperialism as strategy, and that they do not use forms of marketing in order as means to then support the market. So I say, and it really can come across probably as obvious, but I think it's important to say this is not about a rebrand of global justice.
Yeah, that's a really important point at the end. It's a complete rethink or readjustment of how those processes have been built until now. That's fantastic. Thank you. We're so close to being out of time now, but I was just wondering if you could just let us know what you're working on now and whether it's building on some of the points that we've been discussing today, or whether it's something completely different.
Yes. I'll highlight two things that I'm working on. Both of them build on marketing global justice. One of them is a project on Rosa Luxemburg and international law with my wonderful colleague, Serena Natile. And we are organizing some workshops on Rosa Luxemburg. Rosa Luxemburg features prominently in my final chapter in Marketing Global Justice. And she was an amazing revolutionary and thinker of political economy. And I think there is a lot of potential in learning from her from her political economy, but also learning from her activism. So that's something that I'm quite excited about as a project. And then I'm working on, while I was writing Marketing Global Justice, towards the end of finishing Marketing Global Justice, I had a feeling that this highlighting of competition as part of neoliberalism that was so key in the 1990s, I had a feeling that I was somehow starting to be out of touch with what is happening today, which I think is the monopolization rather than the centering of competition. And I couldn't put it in the book because it would have otherwise been two parts. So that's my project at the moment, thinking about how have international legal structures and how has the international legal order gone from focusing on competition, as I think was very central in the 1990s and has been very central in the global justice sector, to supporting the monopolization of power and wealth. And in particular, there I'm interested in rentier capitalism and how rentier capitalism, as the exclusive control over certain assets and the making of those assets exclusive, how that has been supported through international law. It seems like a continuation of Marketing Global Justice, really of thinking about the 21st century and thinking about what is different now and how has that come about, again thinking about the legacies of colonialism there. And in my very final, perhaps gratuitously, in my very final page in Marketing Global Justice, I mentioned climate justice because I had this sense that, or climate disaster, I had this sense that perhaps focusing on international criminal law, even if it does, you know, acknowledge a definition of ecocide and so on, perhaps really what we should be focusing is on as academics is understanding climate disaster. And for me, understanding the international legal institutions and norms that are continuing climate disaster. So I'm thinking about how rentier capitalism and climate disaster are enabled through international law and its legacies of colonialism.
Wow, loads to look forward to. Now, I'm really, really intrigued by all of those projects. I think it'll be fascinating to see how they build on what is, you know, a brilliant book, Marketing Global Justice, but also thinking about that, those material aspects of international criminal law, but broader international institutions that I think it's a brilliant project, and I'm really looking forward to reading it and learning more about your future projects. But I just wanted to thank you again for taking the time to talk us through your brilliant book again today. And I learned so much from reading the book, so thank you. Thank you so much, and hopefully we'll be having you back on the show at some point to discuss any future projects.
Thanks so much. Thank you.